It is Led Zeppelin 4 behind Thriller's, what you call it, Michael Jackson's Thriller, up to about 30 million sales, the album. It's re-released this weekend, as I mentioned earlier on, with all the extra stuff that goes with it as well, as is Hands of the Holy, the fifth album. And that's what this is all about here now. By the way, we have now Jimmy Page we're going to be talking to, because Jimmy, you were with us here on the programme 6 months ago when you brought out the first three Led Zeppelin albums, and now this weekend it's the big middle two, as I mentioned. In other words, albums four and five. So what is next? I mean, are you getting down to work now on the final four, if you like, from Physical Graffiti onwards?
Well, what happened here, Dave, is that I tackled all of the albums all in one long, one epic journey, if you like, and I had to make sure that when the first three albums were released, that everything was completed all the way through to Coda. So everything, really, Coda was the last album of Led Zeppelin. So,
yeah.
Everything had to have the same amount of attention all the way through. So it was totally balanced, if you like, and the same attention to each album. And the same with four and five, as what there was with Led Zeppelin 2 and Led Zeppelin 3. So there is, right across all of these things, there's different. On the odd occasion, you'll find something which comes through which has never been heard before. You know, a song that's never been released. But on Led Zeppelin 4 here, there's different mixes in the final stages. But there's also like different raw basic tracks of things and vignettes of the acoustic numbers with no vocals, and you know, it's a different take on the original.
Okay, do you find in some ways when you look back, Jimmy, at the actual first time recording, i.e. Led Zeppelin 4, that it really does represent the band's personal and probably artistic peak?
I think what it is, it's such a concentrated it's a real concentrated effort. The only other time, the first album was a concentrated effort, even though, you know, it was one studio and pretty much one studio, and we were getting in there whenever we could, and it took 36 hours or so to complete the overall project. But here in Led Zeppelin 4, there's a new element that comes into the equation, and that's Headley Grange. And Headley Grange is a house in the country in Hampshire over here in England, and it had been used as a rehearsal location for other bands. No one had recorded there, but you could actually stay there, and I thought it would be a really good idea to get, you know, that everyone committed to the idea of going into this place, eating, sleeping, and then just making music and having a recording truck, which actually was a Rolling Stones mobile truck, to actually document the whole process.
And everybody plays on this album so honestly and with such conviction. I presume the answer is 100% yes, that the recording environment at Headley Grange brought out, quite simply, the very best in the band.
Well, it was conducive to actually work. And, I mean, it did work. It worked as an idea, but it also as a work ethic of going in there and let's see what can be done. And there's extremes that go on there, like extremes of Levy's song, Levy breaks through to the sort of caressing quality of Going to California. I mean, it really encapsulates the band really, really working very well at that point of time.
It really does. But also, do you think Led Zeppelin 3 allowed you and allowed your fans to realise the other side of Led Zeppelin, if you like, to take 4 and 5 to blues and jazz and folk and country and funk and even reggae? I mean, like, they're both on, funk and reggae are on House of the Holy. Do you think it allowed you to do that? And you were extremely happy that regardless of what people might have said reviewing the albums, the fans were prepared to listen with open ears and go with Led Zeppelin, and it didn't just have to be blues-based rock.
Well, no, I think what it was with Led Zeppelin was that the fans got it really early.
Yeah.
Certainly by the time we did the third album, exactly what it was, what was going to happen, that each album was going to be different from the one beforehand, sometimes quite radically different. And that's right. That's what we should have done, because we had the musical ability to be able to take things in all different directions. That's what we should have done. But we were doing that, and because we weren't locked into a singles market where you'd have to keep doing singles, we could just keep expanding the whole musical horizons with albums.
And the bit about the singles, and the bit about No Name on the cover of the album, I mean, the guys sat you down and said, look, you're a huge band, one of the biggest in the world, this is career suicide, you cannot do this. You were the one, more or less, saying, I'm doing this, get lost.
Well, it was Ahmet Ertegun who said, I remember him actually saying that's professional suicide to be touring without having an album out. Well, I mean, he was actually thinking sort of 43 years ahead of time, really, because it would be now.
Yeah.
Because it'd be all over the internet. But in that day, no, we were just sticking out for wanting to do this thing with no information on the album and let the music, because we knew that the music that was inside this Led Zeppelin 4 on the vinyl or whatever it was then, you know,
yeah,
that it was going to really, really blow people's minds and, you know, blow things apart. So, yeah, it was worth sticking to what you really wanted.
Yeah, and also you could cut out the middleman if you like. You didn't have to do any press, really. You didn't have to do any interviews or such. You didn't put the name, as I say, on the album cover, anything like that. You went directly to the fans and you trusted the fans.
Dave, you got it spot on the nail, because all we had to do in those days was just record music and go out and play. And you know, you didn't get caught up in, like, making videos and this, that and the other. No, that's all you had to do. Or going on chat shows and doing a little bit of music. It was not that. We were going out and playing to the sort of faithful who were buying your records. So it was a good exchange and it all worked, yeah.
Okay, well, look, I played a bit of Black Dog. Let's just play a tiny bit of Rock and Roll. Soul is the song, that is Led Zeppelin, that's the second one. Now listen, Jimmy, the album starts off with two classic rock statements, but then it goes into a different thing altogether. The only time anybody has ever shared vocals on a Led Zeppelin track, which is the late Sandy Denny. The Battle of Evermore, it's very intense and atmospheric. How does a song like that come about?
Well, how it comes about is really, when you hear the finished product with Sandy Denny and all that, it's quite unusual to think that actually it came out of inspiration of playing a mandolin. I hadn't played a mandolin before. The tuning's different, you know, from a guitar. And John Paul Jones had brought his mandolin along to Headley Grange, and he was sort of sitting there, and he was to play it later on going to California, I might add, but I thought, I'll have a crack on this, and I think he was having a cup of tea at the time. And I played this. I started playing it. And, you know, you start getting your head around a different instrument, you start playing. And really, I had the whole structure of Battle of Evermore together in a very, very short time. And then, we did a version, like with acoustic and the mandolin. And that's what's on the companion album. You can hear. That's how it starts. And then Robert started to put lyrics to it. And then he wanted to. He had the idea of wanting to, you know, do it as a duet. And Sandy Denny was the. She was like the best at the time who was around.
And she was like the town crier on the song. Okay, well then hold on. Let's just take a little bit of
it.
This is Battle of Evermore. That intro you've just heard there is, of course, the intro to one of the most famous songs in the history of music, let alone rock music or pop music or whatever. It's an ultimate rock and roll moment. Let's just take a look here, Jimmy. Stairway to Heaven. Three distinct kind of strands to the song, do you think? Like that opening, there's the middle bit, if you like, and then there's the kind of when Bono comes in, or when John Bonham comes in after about 4.5.
Bono might have been there, you never know. I'm sure the spirit of Bono was there.
Okay, when John Bonham comes in about 4.5 minutes, then he adds the rhythmic element and off you go to the calm refrain, the a cappella end, etc. So is that the way you had it together, or was it just, was it just pieces you had?
No. I mean, I don't really like talking about these things because it all gets really distorted and you get sound bites that come round the wrong way. But what I can say is that I had sections that I was going to mould together into this thing, and that's what I did. And I had to, you know, I routined it with the band anyway, that's what it is. The intention of the song was to have something that opened up with a really sort of fragile guitar in the sort of elements of, well, fooled around with a little bit of classical guitar, but it's in that sort of counterpoint aspect of the melody. But then it keeps unfolding as it goes through in layers. And not only does the momentum intensify, but also the tempo of it increases as well. And the whole thing was supposed to, and does, reach this sort of climax at the end.
And as you put it before, it kind of motors. It doesn't necessarily race.
No, it doesn't race. No, it's very steady in its intensity.
That is that track, which is the last track on side one, of course, of the album. Now, rather than go through everything, can I just jump for 1 second to the fifth album, Houses of the Holy, before I go back to number four? Because Houses of the Holy, like my favourite Zeppelin song of both these albums is on that, which is the Rain song. Again, how does that one get together and what happens with that? I mean, that's different Led Zeppelin to me.
Well, that's something that I had... I got all of that together at home as far as all the sections of it. Again, it's sections, isn't it? But that's how it is. You sort of add and subtract and all of that when you're working on these things. But I had a home demo of that, and I'd attempted to put some Mellotron on it to sort of show the sort of sketch of where it would be, where the Mellotron would come. But John Paul Jones does the most fantastic part on the Mellotron on that. But, the whole of that I took it to the party, if you like, when it was time to do Houses of the Holy.
Okay, well, let's take a little quick listen to it. This is the Rain song from Houses of the Holy. Actually, it's from the companion album, which you get with the album released this weekend. This is this version of it, okay? At 17 minutes to 11, 51552, we're talking to Jimmy Page. And it is a song from Houses of the Holy. Funny, you mentioned John Paul Jones a couple of times there. If everybody mentions everybody in Led Zeppelin, you know, Robert Plant on vocals, you on guitar, there's John Bonham on drums. Yeah. Do you think it's much that John Paul Jones is more than just saying John Paul Jones on bass, i.e. that he really is Led Zeppelin's secret weapon?
Well, I don't know about secret weapon, but he managed to shine in the group of Led Zeppelin. I think everybody... Look, as far as like my guitar playing, like I'd played some pretty good guitar along the way and Yardbirds and all of that. Mm. But given the vehicle of Led Zeppelin, I certainly was able to play. I wanted to make a guitar showcase in the first album, and that's what I did. But even so, the whole ethos of the band as I saw it was that everybody would be shining equally. It wasn't just going to be one superstar with a little bit of backing, that everyone was going to gel together. And this is what, you know, we were very fortunate that the personnel came together like that. But just in so much as John Bonham never had the chance to play drums a la John Bonham, as you know it, in Led Zeppelin, it was the same for John Paul Jones. He might have... you know, done a little bit, you know, some session musician. He might have played organ, he might have played bass, but all of a sudden he gets a chance to really musically flex his muscles the same way as everyone else was doing, Robert too.
Do you think in some ways that on John Bonham, like if I was to play the one song that might best sort of, you know, point to what he does in terms of these two albums, Led Zeppelin 4 and Houses of the Holy, in other words 4 and 5, that I could look at When the Levee Breaks?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's such character drumming that... I think, you know, from the first album, Good Times, Bad Times, just changed drumming, period. But this changes the set. This changes the whole approach to recorded drums, really. I mean, it did from the first album, but suddenly people really notice when you've got this sort of ambience to the drums. No one had heard anything like that before, and I was really quite happy to be able to do this. Do you know what I mean? But his playing was just such wonderful character playing that it's not surprised me when people say, well, you know, it was like, you know, hip-hop was really rooted to that drumming. Well, fair enough. You know, it was inspired, his playing would inspire a whole... multiple generations of drummers and players and people who enjoy music.
Let's take a quick listen then to John Bonham on When the Levee Breaks. There you go, When the Levee Breaks, that is John Bonham. Finally, Jimmy, just with these two albums, the next ones are going to come in good time. But just, you have other stuff out there too. You have your own book out there too, which was out before in some ways. Your autobiography is quite different to a lot of people. It does tell the whole story brilliantly, but it tells it mostly in pictures.
It is. It's basically an autobiography in photographs. So it goes back to when I'm 13, and then bands and groups and all people will know this, you know, when they've sort of played with a few mates and that in people's front rooms or in their garage. It's got these sort of photographs, all pre-Beatles, and then it goes on all the way through, session musician, Yardbirds, Led Zeppelin, The Firm with Paul Rodgers, and it goes through all these different incarnations. Yeah. And you see the sort of fashions changing and the guitars pretty much...
Yeah, the Gibson Les Paul standard, that last bit, that's there from the word go.
Yeah, 6-string maniac.
Yeah, indeed. Well, listen, Jimmy, thank you very much indeed for talking to us, and we look forward to the next bunch of albums after these two. Thanks very much,
Jimmy. Hey, thanks, Dave. And I must say, that when you said about Sandy Denny and the town crier, that was flipping great analogy, man. That was fantastic.
Thank you very much, Jimmy.
Cheers.
Good luck. Take it easy. Thanks.
Okay,
bye. Bye-bye. Bye.